So with that much money, $160, $180 million, employees and humans in general tend not to treat every dollar as important. And in any startup environment, you know, it's always going to take you longer than you thought. It's always going to cost more than you thought. And you have to treat your investors' money very carefully. And you don't want to, you know, be so frugal that you stunt the growth of the company or prevent the company from achieving its potential. But you always have to make sure that whatever investment you're making with the money that's been given to the company, that you're getting the most value back for.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christine Renato. I'm the director of the UCSF Rosenman Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. And welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. Today, we're talking to Matt Likens, CEO of GT Medical. GT Medical is last year Rosenman Innovators that is commercializing a technology for brain tumor surgery. Surgery for brain tumor is different from other cancers because the surgeon has to ensure no healthy brain is removed. This means that some cancer cells remain and they grow back very quickly. GT Medical's product is gamma tiles, which are small tiles containing radioactive seeds. At the end of a brain surgery, there's a cavity where the tumor used to be. The surgeon can now tile this cavity with gamma tiles, which immediately starts killing cancer cell. Gamma tiles have been shown to push back the recurrence by many months in patients. Matt joined GT Medical as its CEO in 2017. He has led the company to recent successes that include a $10 million Series A round and FDA clearance for gamma tiles. Matt's early working years were in medical device sales, and he had an impressive 23-year career with Baxter Healthcare. And in 2008, he became a first-time CEO with Altera, a startup in the aesthetic space. Matt led Altera almost all the way to an IPO, but just before that could happen, Altera was acquired for $600 million. One more thing. Come join us to our 6th annual Rosenman Symposium on June 19th here at UCSF Mission Bay Campus. Our speakers include John Grudelors, CEO of Hillrom, Dr. T.P. McKinsey of UCSF, who performed a world-first stem cell transplant to a fetus last summer. Also featured this year is Stan Rowe, CEO of Next Biomedical, a partnership with Deerfield Management, where Deerfield has put aside up to $275 million to this project. Check out this year's lineup at our website, rosenmaninstitute.org. Well, welcome, Matt. Thanks for calling me today from Arizona. Before we start, maybe you can tell everybody a little bit about what you're doing in Arizona. I know you joined this GT Medical a couple years ago now as the CEO. Tell us more about it.
Yes, well, I actually got to Arizona in July of 2006 to become CEO of another startup company called Altera at the time. And 8 years into it, we filed to go public with our S-1 document and ended up being acquired by a German pharmaceutical company. And then following that, I had a 2-year retention agreement and lived through that. And then actually had a role at MedTech Venture Partners there, but we've decided to stay in Arizona after that experience with Altera. And I think my wife and I were both a little tired of moving. We've moved quite a few times in our marriage. And so we love Arizona. We're staying here. And the founders of GT Medical Technologies happened to be from Arizona. And when I met them, it was a great opportunity to move forward in a new challenge, in an exciting technology.
Yeah, so that's before we embark on more detail about GT Medical, maybe we can start a little bit. I know when you start your career, you were working for J&J, and because you mentioned that you moved quite a bit throughout your marriage. So what's your role at J&J? How do you get to J&J to become doing a CEO of a startup companies, two startup companies?
Yes. And so I did start right out of school too many years ago to actually say exactly when it was. But right out of school, went to work for J&J in a sales role but I was selling industrial tape for the Permacell Tape Company, competing with 3M. And 3M was the dominant supplier of 300 different types of industrial tapes, and J&J was in second place. 3M had about 80% market share, J&J had 10%, and there were three or four other competitors. And so had nothing to do with healthcare at all for the 3 years I was there, but learned a few valuable lessons. But after 3 years, and they had transferred me from Minnesota, which was my first territory, and competing with 3M in Minnesota is quite a challenge unto itself. And they transferred me to Houston, Texas, which was a much larger industrial opportunity. And at that point, about 6 months later, I joined Baxter Healthcare.
Okay.
And then had a 23-year career at Baxter Healthcare in a number of different roles.
So you mentioned that you learned a lot from your selling the industrial tape and then moved to healthcare. What are the things that, three things that you learned that stick still till this day stick with you that you learned from the J&J training?
Yeah, so on a lighter note, I learned rejection very early in my professional career. And so when you're a 10% market share owner and you're competing against an 80% market share owner and the company is 3M, and you happen to be in 3M's backyard in the Twin Cities, I heard no a lot more times than I heard, yes, we'll consider your product as an alternative to the 3M product we're using. And so that was one thing. You learn rejection, and you learn not to take it personally, that it's, you know, no really means no only for the time being. You know, it might turn around. I also learned that any provider of a technology that gains a dominant market share over time, they may not, they may get a little comfortable with that market share. Yet they may not have the same sense of urgency that a second supplier might have. So that was another thing that if I were to be in a position in my career where I became a dominant supplier, I wanted to make sure that we still operated as if we were the underdog each time. So that was valuable. And the last thing is that there is room for a valued second supplier. You know, even in an 80%, 10% ratio, if I could go into a large possible opportunity and talk to them about how all of their business should not be with one supplier, they should manage their supply chain risk by having, let's say, 20% of their business with me as the trusted second supplier, that was still double the market share that we had nationwide. And so it was a huge win for me. It lowered their risk from a supply chain standpoint. And frankly, 3M never missed it. So it wasn't like, it was kind of win-win-win all the way around. And I actually did very well once I got into that mode of not trying to get all the business, but just my fair share, which was a lot more than what I had at that point in time. So lots of lessons learned there.
Oh, that's interesting. That's, you know, because sometimes it can be very discouraging when you are on that 10% market share, when you have to compete with somebody that, you know, remembering that, I think that is really important. It's hard to remember that at the same time.
Yeah, and actually, Christine, you know, a few years later, when I was with Baxter, and I was with the Fenwall division of Baxter, which really focused on blood collection systems and blood transfusion sets and apheresis systems and blood warmers, everything to collect blood and process it and transfuse it back into patients, we were the dominant market share leader at that point. And so I didn't want to become that comfortable leader. I wanted to make sure that we were still operating in a way where we were earning the business day in and day out. So you know, competing against 3M and seeing that they were sometimes taking that business for granted really was helpful for me as I moved into Baxter.
Mm. When you say taking things for granted, what does that mean?
Yeah, it means, you know, not getting back to the customer in a timely fashion. It means not responding with a sense of urgency when they have questions about your technology. You know, it's that type of thing versus, you know, it's in the car rental business, you know, for years, Avis would say, we try harder, right? Because Hertz was the dominant rental car company. And Avis came out and first of all, they gave ownership to every Avis employee was an owner of the company. And they knew they were by far the in second place in market share in rental cars. And so they came out with this advertising campaign, we try harder. And they certainly did. They were more responsive. They had a little better pricing. You know, they would be flexible. If they had an upgrade available when you were renting a car from them, you were likely to get it. Something that the dominant player would not have done because they didn't have to do that. So it's that attitude.
I see. So so you make that transition from J&J with all that knowledge and understanding to Baxter. And what role were you playing at Baxter?
Yeah, so starting with a field sales role, I had a territory that covered all of South Texas and into Louisiana, calling on community blood centers and then the major transfusion centers in that area. So the Houston Medical Center with Methodist Hospital and St. Luke's and Herman Hospital and Bentaub Trauma Center and the VA Hospital. I mean, there was so much business just in Houston itself, but also covered San Antonio, Austin, out to El Paso, Corpus Christi. It was really a great territory. And it had probably 15 major blood centers calling on with, you know, three really large ones and then some other community centers.
And at this time, you probably already have a sales team under your umbrella.
I did not. No, I was just in the field as a rep for about 3 years. And I did very well. And in fact, you know, maybe an interesting story. I'm on the job for 2 weeks. You have to realize that I just come from training in Chicago and, you know, I'm in the medical field for the first time. I mean, I've been selling tape, you know, masking tape, strapping tape, you know, not very technical, right?
Colorful.
And now it's all about, yeah, but it's all about blood and the circulation system and red cells and plasma and platelets and, you know, how these things can be utilized in a therapeutic fashion. I mean, it was really fascinating, but 2 weeks out of training, I'm down in Houston and I see that, gee, Methodist Hospital is transfusing more blood than any other institution in my territory. I'm going to go in because I have a microaggregate blood filter that's brand new, 5-layer graduated density design, non-woven polyester fiber, and this can transfuse up to 10 units of blood, remove the microaggregates before it clogs up. So I got to get into Methodist Hospital. So you know, I go right through the doors, 6:30 one morning, you know, even though they say, you know, you're not allowed in here. Training taught me, no, just push that automatic button. The door will open and you go in. And so I go in and I have my new filter in my hand. And this gentleman of short stature comes up to me and with a big Texas drawl and a deep voice, he says, young man, may I help you? And I said, well, yes, sir. I'm Matt Likens, and I'm with the Fenwell Division of Baxter. And we've just launched this new microaggregate filter. And I understand you transfuse more blood here than any other institution in my territory. And he said, well, tell me more about it. So I detailed it to him. And he said, well, can you prime that thing? And I said, yes, sir, I can. He said, well, you go scrub up and come right into my surgery this morning. And I did. And I went into open heart surgery. 2 weeks on the job, and you either find that disgusting or you find that fascinating. And fortunately, I found it fascinating. But little did I know, I was talking to Dr. Michael DeBakey.
Oh.
You know, one of the leading heart transplant and cardiologists, cardiac surgeons ever, right?
Yeah.
And it's probably a good thing I didn't know who he was, or I would not have been as composed. So, and the better news is that coming out of that procedure, the product worked beautifully, and he decided 2 weeks later to convert the entire hospital to these new filters. And so the people in Chicago at our home office said, who is this guy that we hired in South Texas? And a couple months later, Dr. Denton Cooley at St. Luke's Hospital, right next door, the second leading transfuser of blood in my territory, did a similar thing with him. He converted as well. And I knew I'd found a calling at that point.
I see. This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. And then, so you stayed in the field for 3 years?
I did, and then got promoted to Deerfield, Illinois, just north of Chicago, as a field sales assistant. So you're basically the right-hand person for the VP of sales. So, you know, you put together sales contests, sales training programs, you work with people in the field, and learn as much as you can in preparation for going back out to the marketplace as a regional manager. And so that was a one-year stint in Chicago, and then out to Denver, Colorado, and I was the regional manager for everything, you know, Rockies and West, with six sales representatives working with me.
Okay. Well, that's a good jump. And so you learned to manage people and a team?
I did. And, you know, so lesson learned there also, you know, I was very successful in sales. And so as a first-time manager, if I had a few people on the team who weren't as successful, I tried to turn them into me.
How did that work?
Well, that didn't work very well. You know, it took me a little while, but I realized that they had to be who they were. You know, I could provide some advice and some suggestions, but I couldn't turn them into me. They needed to be the best salesperson they could be based upon their unique characteristics, mm-hmm. you know, and their personal qualities. And so, you know, it took a while, but that became clear over a period of time, and was out in that role actually for 5 years, Christine, and may have been the best job I had, because very seldom would anybody from corporate come out to work with you. So it was like you were running your own business mm-hmm. out there, and we had tremendous growth. We were launching new products. We had the first closed system apheresis technology that allowed you to store platelets for 5 to 7 days in a closed system. And single donor platelets were very popular at that time. So it was really a blast. Really had fun.
Well, that's kind of nice, because you're kind of in a large company, but it's more like in a small environment. So you have that both world in your environment. So you mentioned earlier about, you know, having the sales rep to stay to be themselves, but I'm sure you provide a lot of the mentoring and you know, provide some sort of a framework so that they can be the best salesperson the way they are. And how do you approach that, and what kind of things that you do to ensure that to happen?
Yes, I thought it was important for me as the regional manager to be quite visible in the marketplace. And so I would be out every week. And so so every 6 weeks, I would work with each of the reps, you know, for about 3 days. I'd have a Monday in the office, a Friday in the office. Monday afternoon, I'd be heading out to whether it was L.A. or San Francisco or Seattle or Utah and working with individual reps. And so being there with them allowed them to set up maybe more important meetings than they would have set up themselves, because, you know, the supervisor is in town. And then I was expected to provide, you know, maybe more details about the company and the technology and the story. And so by working together and them, first of all, I could observe the way they were building relationships. They could also observe the way I was trying to complement their efforts, and then being able to provide a little more detail as far as the company and technology, and they could learn from that. That worked really well. And I felt like I was really in touch with the marketplace. So that's and we built a really great team, and there was a lot of cross communication, and we were all in it together. So it was just a great environment.
No, that's good. And then, so after that, you move up the corporate ladder within Baxter. What was the last position that you were at Baxter, and what's that role like?
Yeah, so several positions happened. After the 5 years in Denver, the president of that division of Baxter came out and worked with me. And after 3 days of working with me in the field, and again, I didn't see people from corporate very often, he said, if I can use the exact term that he used, he said, "Matt, what the hell are you doing out here?" And I said, and this was Mr. Tony White. and I said, "Excuse me, Tony, I thought we had a really good week. I don't quite understand your question." And he said, "No, we had a great week. This region is just killing it. But you've been here 5 years. I need you. I need you in international marketing. You know, we've got a business outside the U.S. that's not getting nearly enough attention. And your degree's in marketing. I want you to be my international marketing guy." And I said, "Oh, well, we really enjoy it in Denver, you know, and things are going well here." And sure enough, a couple months later, I was back in Chicago again and had a role in global marketing. And then ended up being a vice president of global marketing over a period of time. And then actually moved to Europe and became vice president of marketing for Baxter Biotech Europe, which was blood collection, transfusion medicine, and the hemophilia business and plasma proteins business. And that was for 3 years, from about 1993 to 1996. And so that was a fantastic experience living in Munich, Germany. Our children, our son and daughter, 9 and 6 years old, respectively, at the time. And so I think we all grew from that experience. And then moved back to the U.S. to become president of Baxter Biotech North America, which was almost $1 billion in revenue at that time. Again, it seemed like I had about 10 different positions at Baxter over the 23 years. And it seemed like every time I was ready for taking that next step, there was another opportunity available to me. So just a great experience.
That's a nice thing about large companies. Sometimes you got to move around quite a bit because they have a lot to offer. But what gives you the bug of the startups? You're working at Baxter for a long time, and then you decide to move on to the startup world.
Yeah. And so in 1998, the company decided to move the headquarters of biotech for North America to Southern California, Thousand Oaks. And that was not a great time for us to move for a number of family reasons. And so I left the role of president of Biotech North America and became the president of the dialysis business in the U.S. for the last 3 years I was there. And I think Baxter did a great job in peritoneal dialysis, which allows patients to ambulate and to have a more normal life and greater homeostasis based upon continuously removing waste from the bloodstream. But I found that to be a very depressing business in that there had been no major advancements in the treatment of patients with end-stage renal disease. And I'd gotten to the point 3 years in that role that I was looking for something new. And, you know, you get a phone call from a recruiter. They have a well-funded startup in South Florida, raised $180 million.
Wow.
They have 14 different technologies, drugs, diagnostics, and devices. And I thought, maybe this is what I'm meant to do. And deep down inside, I always wanted to be involved in something brand new to see if I could, you know, be influential in building something from nothing. And so one thing led to another. And in January of 2001, went to South Florida as a CEO, but as an executive VP of operations for the startup company based in Fort Lauderdale.
What was that experience like, your first startup company with $160 million? That's quite large.
Yes. Well, that's right. I mean, for a startup, that was, you know, not the most risky startup in that I knew we had, you know, some runway with that much money in the bank.
It's a good baby step there.
Yeah. And so to cut to the chase, though, I'd like to say that I learned everything not to do in a startup in the 5 years there. And so it wasn't the most pleasant experience, but it was helpful in that for a number of reasons, it wasn't the right environment, and there was only so much any individual could do to control that environment. So lessons learned there that were really helpful as I became a CEO for the first time in the middle of 2006 with the Ulthera opportunity in Mesa, Arizona.
So what kind of things that you learned not to do that you apply that so that you make sure you don't do that sort of thing at your startups now?
Yeah, so with that much money, $160, $180 million, employees and humans in general tend not to treat every dollar as important. And in any startup environment, you know, it's always going to take you longer than you thought. It's always going to cost more than you thought. And you have to treat your investors' money very carefully. And you don't want to, you know, be so frugal that you stunt the growth of the company or prevent the company from achieving its potential. But you always have to make sure that whatever investment you're making with the money that's been given to the company, that you're getting the most value back for. And I don't think we operated that way all the time in South Florida. So that was one thing. I think the other thing is it can't be all about the CEO. And in the company in South Florida, yeah, that's the way it was. And no one was very motivated as a result of that. So it's really all about the team. And the third thing is it really doesn't matter what technology you have. You know, you've seen very poor technologies that achieve tremendous market share and improve patients' lives because you have the right team together with the right priorities moving together in sync. And then there are great technologies that often never quite make the impact because it's the wrong team and the wrong priorities and things get in the way. So all of those things were part of that 5-year learning experience in South Florida.
That's great. Even the $160 million can run out as well when you spend it not very wisely.
Exactly.
So you mentioned about having the team to be in sync is important. How do you ensure that? Because sometimes when everybody's busy running around, it's important to make sure, you know, like you said, that everybody's in sync. How, as a CEO, as a leader, how do you make sure it happen?
Yeah, so I'm a big follower of this book written by Vern Harnish, and it's called Scaling Up. And it's a second, he may have written more books, but it's a second version of a book he wrote 10 years ago called The Rockefeller Habits. It was really studying the habits of J.D. Rockefeller and the tremendous industrialist that he was and the success that he had. And in Scaling Up, it's a refinement of the approach that was in The Rockefeller Habits. And it's really a great outline of that should be followed for any company in early stages trying to establish growth and traction. And so the meeting rhythm that you establish with your team in a very consistent fashion, as various stages of growth, cash is the most important thing. At other stages, leadership is the most important thing. At other stages, getting the right additional people hired is the most important thing. And being able to anticipate what stage of growth you are going through so that you can be prepared for it and be thinking about that on an ongoing basis as the company grows. So it's been great. And I learned a lot about that over the time I've been in Arizona. And I'm a big proponent of that.
Yeah, that's good. Do you think, I mean, reading that book and the fact that you have a lot of experience help you identify when is the right time to make that transition, whether it's the leadership that's important right now or the next hiring? I mean, how do you know that? Where do you get your advice?
Yeah, so for the last 10 years also, I've been part of a group here called Arizona Growth Advisors. And there are 10 or 12 president CEOs who get together for a half a day every month. And, you know, we can't all make every half day session, but every month there's probably 7 or 8 of us who are there. And we teach each other about our businesses, about our challenges, We have topics that we can tee up each time we get together and get input from the others. There's an educational portion of each month's segment. In fact, they're the ones that introduced me to Vern Harnish and Scaling Up. And I found that that group has become an informal council or mentorship group in that in different businesses and industries, but a lot of experiences that might be relevant to the challenges that each of us are facing. Because, you know, when you're in the CEO role, it's there are often things that you just can't talk to your team about. And to get unvarnished outside advice or perspectives on it can be really helpful.
Do you think how important it is to have the advice from CEO from different industry?
Yeah, I found it to be quite useful. And, you know, so I think the general category here is nobody knows it all, right? And so this whole spirit of lifelong learning. So I think the CEO, as much as anybody else, has got to make sure they continue to be exposed to the latest thinking on hiring, on you know, so what are compensation packages and how do you motivate folks and what's the, you know, what are the latest marketing trends and, you know, how do you manage cash more effectively? You know, there's so many different disciplines that you need to be aware of and have some expertise in, and things are changing all the time. So having a, dedicated time every month to try to keep up with that. And it's not just this half day meeting, but also reading as much as you can on an ongoing basis so that the world's not passing you by and you're keeping up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you obviously had a good outcome, a successful result with running Ulthera. You mentioned earlier that the company was planning to do IPO and then end up getting acquired. How has that changed from the plan to do IPO and then later to just you chose to step the acquisition path, which is a better way, I think. How do you create that, you know, transition and change?
Yeah, from filing the for an IPO, but ended up being acquired. Yeah, so we filed in late January of 2014. You know, it was an expensive process. I mean, there were two of the major accounting firms that were auditing each other's work in order to do that. Overall, to prepare for the IPO, you know, cost us roughly $5 million. But we were at a point where we were approaching $100 million in annual revenue. We were profitable. We had roughly a $20 million bottom line. And our business had become fairly predictable. We felt like we could forecast very accurately, and we felt like we had brought on the right professionals so that we earned the right to become a public company. And so filed with the SEC. They had questions. We filed an amendment to answer those questions. They had more questions. We filed a second amendment to answer those questions. And by the time we got through that process, the 90 days of confidentiality with our filing was over. And so as a result of that, then the world could see the 300-page S-1 document. And it was actually very impressive that, you know, our growth over the years and our profitability. And at that point, there were three companies that expressed interest in acquiring Ulthera. And once the bidding got up to $600 million, you know, we had a board meeting and it was a bit of a tug of war. It wasn't a clear choice because we felt we could be a valuable public company, but decided that it sounded pretty good. And we decided to take that offer.
So that everybody's happy with that offer instead of going through the whole IPO process.
Yeah, I wouldn't say everybody was happy with it, but I'd say that... you know, the uncertainty of the public markets, as opposed to having a check for $600 million or that type of remuneration, you know, we decided to take what was on the table versus the uncertainty.
Yeah, before you have that tremendous success, you know, what you built in Ulthera is pretty impressive. I mean, because it does take a while. I remember that's going through the 2008, you have to raise more money and you have to get more data that you were not anticipating. Can you tell us more of that journey, the challenge that you have to overcome to get where where their company is ready for acquisition?
Yeah, so I mentioned early in my career learning rejection very early as a sales representative competing with 3M in Minnesota. That served me very well as I was trying to raise the Series B and Series C rounds of financing for Ulthera, where, you know, in the height of the financial crisis, raising money was, you know, it's never easy, but it was really hard. And so literally talked to hundreds of folks. But finally, you know, the financing came through. We ended up raising $40 million in the three rounds of financing. And then to sell for $600 million, I think everybody, all constituencies were pleased with that type of financial result. But doesn't mean it wasn't hard. Biggest challenge we had at Ulthera was a 3.5 year odyssey with the FDA because the technology was so novel that there was no predicate device. So we had a de novo application. And at that point, there was no specific time frame in which the FDA was required to get back to companies that filed de novos. That's changed now. But at that time, there wasn't. And they took their time. So we launched outside of the U.S. and Europe and Asia. And my global marketing experience in the past was very helpful at that point. And we got through it. And then once we got FDA and launched in the U.S. in January of 2010, it was a rocket ship. You know, we grew from $5 million in revenue in 2009 to $18 million in 2010, $41 million, $59 million, $82 million. And then the year we were acquired, we finished that year at $117 million in revenue. So, it was really great. We grew to 230 employees, you know, and I was the second employee back in July of 06. Randy Miller was our first employee, and he had a lot of roles with us, and we were really fortunate to be able to attract just top-notch people and had a great environment. And, you know, when it all clicks and, you know, when everybody's working together and pulling in the same direction, there's no better experience than that. I'm really fortunate to have been part of that.
Yeah, it must be a fun experience. And before, you know, some of our listeners probably don't know what Ulthera technology is. Maybe if you can give us a quick summary what the technology is and was acquired later by Merck, and maybe tell us a little bit.
Yeah, and so most of the listeners are probably into real healthcare, real medicine, right?
I don't know.
and that's what I was in previously. And you know, at Baxter, our mantra for all those years was critical therapies for life-threatening conditions. You know, and we probably took ourselves a little too seriously, but we did feel like if we were successful at deploying our technologies, patient outcomes would be better, and the world would be better off for it. You know. So Ulthera was aesthetic medicine. Okay, there's a big difference. And so we weren't curing anything, right? But we had a focused ultrasound technology developed by Dr. Michael Slayton in Mesa, Arizona, brilliant physicist, 100 patents on the system, focused ultrasound with imaging combined. And we would deposit ultrasound focused energy at three different depths below the surface of the skin, mainly facial and neck procedures. And we would insult that tissue in about an hour-long procedure, roughly 15,000 times, ablating the tissue 15,000 times at depth. And that led to healing and a wound healing response that led to firming, tightening, and lifting of skin in a non-invasive fashion. And we called it Ultherapy. We sold the systems to dermatologists and plastic surgeons. They treated patients. And it worked. You know, a lot of aesthetic technologies come out with a lot of hype, but really don't work very well. Ours worked. We had 55 clinical studies that led to 45 published, peer-reviewed clinical papers, you know, and really described the mechanism of action, and just phenomenal job by the team in being able to be more medically oriented in the aesthetics field. And I think that paid off. The doctors really appreciated the fact that we understood the science and invested in the science behind our technology.
Well, that's good. And do you think your experience being in a more like the Baxter way data is very important that helps drive that direction with when you're at Ulthera, or is more like driven by the market that you need to gather that data in order to drive adoption?
I think the Baxter and J&J experience, and even though J&J was with Tape, J&J, you know, one of the best companies in the world, and now I think they're just about all, you know, medical and healthcare. But I think having that background, you know, and bringing that appreciation for clinical development and science differentiated Ulthera from many or most of the other providers to that industry. And I think it was really appreciated. We charged premium prices, but we also knew that our technology worked and it was very reliable clinical results that patients would pay for. And the doctors investing in an Ulthera system would make a payback within the first 30 to 60 days. So all of the economics made sense as well.
Mm-hmm. This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. So after you did 2 years with MERS, after the acquisition with Ulthera, you have a little gap year, as you call it, and then before you embark on GT Medical, that's more like a therapeutic company. Can you tell us more about GT Medical?
Yes, and it was founded by five brain tumor specialists that at one point in time were all residing at the Barrow Neurological Institute in downtown Phoenix. And the Barrow Institute does more brain and spine procedures than any other institution in the country, at least at last count. And so there was a founding neurosurgeon, Dr. Peter Nakaji, three founding radiation oncologists, and I'll say led by Dr. David Brockman, who is now our chief technology officer. And then their clinical coordinator, a brilliant person, Terry Thomas. The five of them developed a limited liability corporation basically out of desperation in around 2012. And their desperation was the fact that patients who were diagnosed with brain tumors and would undergo surgery for those operable tumors that could be resected or removed inevitably would have those tumors recur. And so that was the idea behind it. And I can tell you more about it, but I ran into these physicians who had made a lot of progress with an IRB approved clinical study. They shared the results with me. They had a tentative offer to license their technology from a major medical device company. And so they wanted my opinion, you know, so I signed a confidentiality agreement, Matt, with doing that, we'll show you the clinical data. We'll show you the terms of this potential licensing agreement. And we're tired of it. They bootstrapped this, you know, for 6 or 7 years at that point in time, over $1 million spent among the group. Wow. And they said, we'd really like to get this in the hands of a major provider. So I looked it all over and I said, okay, my recommendation is don't license it. I think you need to keep the technology. And they were very disappointed in that.
Because they still have to bootstrap along the way?
Well, they did. And they said, what are our other options? I said, well, there's an option that involves changing your LLC into a Delaware-based C-Corp, hire a management team, and raise some money. And get this technology to market. You got to get FDA clearance. You have to finalize reimbursement. And then we'll get the right team together and get it to patients. That's why they formed this in the first place. And 2 weeks later, Dr. Nakaji and Dr. Brockman called me up and said, we're going to follow your advice. How would you like to be CEO? And so, you know, I said, well, I don't really have any background in neurosurgery or brain tumors or cancer for that matter. And they said, doesn't matter. Why don't you do that? And so Brian Martin and I were the first two employees, October 1st of 2017. So we've been at it about a year and a half now.
Okay. And where is the company right now? What state it is now?
Yeah, and Christy, maybe I could just take a second and talk about why this is important therapy.
Yeah,
and so today's standard of care with brain tumors is the following. One is with a brain tumor, and you know, this may be obvious to folks, but it was news to me, but with a brain tumor, the neurosurgeon needs to be very conservative in trying to resect the tumor because the tumor is typically adjacent to what's known as eloquent tissue. So healthy brain tissue that affects movement and speech and memory. And so they know because of that conservative nature, they are leaving residual tumor cells behind in the tumor bed. So this is unlike cancer or tumors elsewhere on the body, where typically the mantra is, you know, get a healthy margin, remove everything, get every last cell you possibly can. And that makes sense outside of the brain, but in the brain, they can't do it that way. So the fact that these residual tumor cells are there, today's standard of care is following that surgical procedure. The wound is closed. The patient's in the hospital for roughly 2 days, and then it's 3 to 4 weeks later, allowing the surgical wound to completely heal before that patient is exposed to 6 weeks of daily external beam radiation to try to address those residual tumor cells, to try to kill those tumor cells so that a recurrence does not happen. And so, and as I mentioned, inevitably the tumors come back. And if you have a second surgical procedure and even go through another course of external radiation, they come back even faster. And so our founders were really desperate for a better answer. And the concept of brachytherapy had been tried previously, but it had been tried basically with raw seeds, bare seeds placed on residual tumor or where they thought residual tumors were. And it was uneven distribution of radiation, and it led to necrosis and other adverse events. But our founder said, gee, if we could have the right carrier and embed the brachytherapy seeds within the carrier so that there's a structural offset that protects the eloquent brain tissue but emits very powerful radiation to the residual tumor cells, maybe that's the answer. And they developed Gammatile as a result of that with a collagen carrier and very precise placement of cesium-131 radiation seeds within that collagen carrier. And so the difference is that in the last 5 minutes of the tumor resection procedure, gamma tiles are deployed. They literally tile the floor and the walls of the tumor cavity that's been created by resecting the tumor. The patient then the wound is surgically, it's closed, still 2 days in the hospital, and that's it. So the radiation goes to work immediately. So if there are residual cells in there, and they're likely to be, the radiation is addressing them, and they're addressing them with 2.5 times the energy within that small space than can be achieved from external sources. So it's very powerful dose of radiation. And then there's no need for additional radiation therapy. And so it's so much more patient friendly. The quality of life improvement is fantastic. And the clinical data shows that we are able to move out time to recurrence months and months beyond what would be expected. And that's for all pathologies, glioblastomas, metastases, meningiomas, you know, any type of tumor growth. The clinical data is very powerful. So that's in a nutshell what Gammatile is all about. And I found it so compelling that I wanted to be part of that and see if we can, you know, kind of get back to the Baxter mantra of critical therapies for life-threatening conditions. And our goal here, our purpose, is improving the lives of patients with brain tumors, as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And we feel like we're just getting started.
And how many patients have you treated so far? After, because you recently got an FDA approval. That was late last year, I believe.
Yes, and so we have several patients treated. We're in our limited market release, and we're we're utilizing some targeted distributors to get this out there, but we only want to do it in a limited way for the first 6 months to make sure that our manufacturing process and our logistics are right. The product has a half-life, so logistics are important as well. But we've had a couple of clinical procedures. They've gone extremely well, and we have a lineup of a lot of the best institutions that you can imagine, you know, getting their radioactive materials license updated and moving through the adoption process. So early stages, but very promising as far as what we've been able to accomplish so far.
No, that is great. It's great to for this patient to have another option. Because there's another company called in the cold cap technology. Basically, you have to be strapped there for a long time while your life is not that long.
Yeah, yeah. So are you talking about the NovoCure Optune system?
Yeah.
Yeah, specifically for glioblastoma, as far as brain tumors. Yeah, that's I think they've got some very impressive data. It's basically a cap, as you said, that the patient wears, and it's emitting force, a magnetic radiation, I believe, to disrupt the replication of glioblastoma cells. Now, which is fine, but it is, you have to wear it 18 hours a day. And I think a minimum of 4 months, and often it's worn much longer than that. And it's at a high price per month that you wear it as well. But I think they're doing a good job with glioblastomas. And in fact, we think that maybe gamma tile used with the Optune device might offer additional benefits, for patients with glioblastoma. And of course, our clearance from the FDA includes all types of tumors, not just glioblastoma.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. I'm looking forward to see more patients get treatment with the gamma tile. And I think wish you luck the best because the patient needs this sort of therapy. And it's good to have you guys working on it.
Yeah, thank you, Christine. And I think you'll be hearing a lot more about this, you know, as we make inroads in this limited market release. And, you know, later this year, September, October timeframe, if things go well, we'll move into a full market release mode and ramp up production and really get this thing rolling. So I look forward to continuing to update you on our progress.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being able to tell a little bit of our story, and I look forward to seeing you again in the Bay Area in the near future.
Sounds good. Thank you.